WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
The local news just wouldn't stop coming this week. Two major trials kicked off. A plane nearly crashed at Midway. Governor Pritzker stopped in Washington over a federal funding freeze. And then there were stories like these in the city and suburbs.
City Council narrowly approving an $830 million bond measure.
It kicks the funding for this to another generation of Chicagoans.
This funding comes at a time when there is a great deal of uncertainty around future federal funding.
Adulton residents are ready for a change. Tiffany Hinyard has been voted out.
Transparency starts today.
I think that people didn't give me a chance.
House won 88% of the vote in what was a bigger turnout than the last election 4 years ago.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly news recap. And today, an all WBEZ panel helped us break it all down. We had criminal justice editor Patrick Smith, city government and politics reporter Tessa Weinberg, and data projects editor Alden Lowry. We started with Chicago and its finances. The mayor's plan to borrow $830 million passed by the narrowest of margins Wednesday. First of all, what's the money for? Here's Tessa.
So this is normally a pretty routine vote. You know, they're borrowing $830 million, and it's all to fund infrastructure improvements. So everything from street and bridge repairs to lead pipe replacements to even those aldermanic menu programs, the menu money that aldermen can use to do improvements in their ward. So kind of anything and everything under the sun with infrastructure improvements. But okay, normally this is routine, and it faced a lot of contention this week in City Council.
Yeah, what happened Wednesday?
Yeah, so Wednesday was when the plan finally was getting a vote after opponents had already delayed it once because there's so much opposition. And the Johnson administration came back. They made some tweaks to this bond plan because there had been some concerns. There was some language in the original ordinance that said, you know, loans or grants could be given to other municipalities, other, you know, forms of government, including school districts. And some alderpersons worried, could this be a way that the city could help CPS out with its budget? You know, there's been a lot of contention between Mayor Johnson and CPS CEO Pedro Martinez over this disputed $175 million pension payment.
Right.
So to quash concerns that, you know, there's no way this could be used for that, it's only for infrastructure, they added some revised language to put some guardrails on. But it was still a really close vote. Alderman Brendan Riley even tried to delay consideration of this all the way till May for months out.
Really?
And a more mayoral ally moved to block that motion, and it was a tie about whether they should, you know, put that away, we're going to vote on it today, or let's delay it. And the mayor had to cast the tie-breaking vote to ensure it did get voted on Wednesday. And even then, it was very close. And
that keeps happening lately.
It does.
Tie-breaking
yeah.
votes by Mayor Johnson. So help us understand the two camps here. Who supported the measure? Who's against it? And what are they saying?
Yeah, so we saw a lot of, you know, mayoral allies supporting this bond plan. And they say these infrastructure fixes are needed now, that it can't wait. Alderman Walter Burnett was one of the people who spoke up in support, and he pointed to his own ward saying, you know, my ward has directly benefited from the millions that have been invested in the West Loop, around the United Center. You can see those investments. It's made the neighborhood what it is today. But, you know, further west, he's like, I still have areas that, you know, need sidewalks that are going to take years to catch up. And they were arguing it's more fiscally responsible to address these infrastructure problems now rather than letting them balloon. But opponents were really skeptical of the city's plan to pay off this debt. You know, it prioritizes paying just the interest initially rather than the principal. And so payments are going to balloon. And I think there was just also a lot of contention coming off this really tense budget season. the city got its credit rating downgraded because of how the budget went and the budget that was passed. And so I think there's also just a lot of skepticism right now in city council over any financial decisions.
Yeah, Alden, let's talk about that, because when it comes to the budget, Chicago just always seems to be between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, that's been kind of the situation in the last few years. I think city of Chicago size, the budget is always going to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. I can remember days when the budget, city budget was $6, $7 billion, and now we're, what, $17, almost $18 billion. Mm-hmm. There was a big lift in the city budget from 2021 to 2022. It went from around $13 billion to about $17, almost $18 billion, kind of the range that we're in now.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we've seen some of these really heated conversations year after year. There's always a budget shortfall, I think close to $1 billion the last couple of years or so. So these conversations are there. One of the things I think is really important kind of looking forward is as the city's budget kind of took that bump up, there was a larger portion of that budget being covered from what they call the grant fund. So those are all the things where money's kind of coming in from the federal government, from the state, places like that. And, you know, how much of that is pandemic era money that might be coming off the table? Mm-hmm. We've got this federal climate now where it's like, hey, look, you know, maybe we're not all that keen about sending federal grant dollars to you, the Sanctuary City conversation, which is going to be happening soon. So, you know, looking forward, the city may be in a much more precarious situation than it is even right now. And so, hence, I think some of the consternation around, do we want to essentially give maybe a payday loan is a little too serious, but still, the payback on this, what, close to $2 billion for $100 million borrowing is still concerning.
What do you think about all this, Patrick?
Well, you know, I hear what Alden's saying, especially the ballooning, budget and the deficit. And yeah, anytime you've got a real difference between how much you're getting and how much you have to pay back, I think it makes sense to have concerns. I will also say it struck me, what Tessa said about these are often routine. I think our colleague Fran's story said, you know, borrowing money like this is usually routine, but not under Mayor Brandon Johnson. And I would say I think there are opponents to borrowing now who have not been opponents to borrowing in the past. And I guess I'm curious why that is.
What changed?
I think it's totally fair to have a principled stand to say we just shouldn't be doing this kind of borrowing. We shouldn't be putting it on future generations. This has always been what we do. I think it's kind of what almost every big municipality does, and maybe, I wonder what the difference is.
Maybe folks are starting to get off the Mayor Brandon Johnson train. I mean, his approval rating is very low. It's still a long way away from the next city election, but, I mean, how long do you want to hitch your wagon politically to a mayor who seems pretty fractured at this time? So I wonder if that's part of what's happening.
Yeah. Now, Alderman Bill Conway, who we heard at the top of the program, argued that the package should have been smaller and structured in a way where future payments were lower for the city. So he pointed out that his kids, who are young right now, they're going to be footing the bill for this decision when they're like 30 years old. Is that an accurate statement, Tessa?
Well, the city is going to be paying this for decades and decades. They're going to make interest-only payments until 2045 about, and then annual payments on the debt are going to balloon into hundreds of millions of dollars all the way into 2050, and it's not until 2055 that these bonds will finally be retired.
Oh, that's a long way away. Yeah.
Yeah, and the city's chief financial officer, she argues that, you know, the city is focused on only paying interest initially because there's still past debt from other deals that the city's paying down. And so it can't afford to be paying both the interest and the principal at the same time, unless we have more revenue coming in, which would mean bigger tax hikes, which City Council also is really opposed to this budget season. So the city's kind of having to make these hard choices of if you want more revenue so we can maybe make payments faster, maybe it also means voting for things like property taxes or other revenue.
And I'm curious, Patrick brought up our Sun-Times colleague, Fran Spielman, earlier, but in her report, she mentioned that some older people were confused about what they were voting on just because of the way that the borrowing plan came up.
Yeah.
What was she talking about?
Like I had mentioned initially, when they had this revised language to make clear this is only for infrastructure projects, the city council has to adopt that revised ordinance. And so there's a little bit of confusion. They adopted that, and some city council members thought the vote that was happening was to adopt the ordinance when it was actually the actual vote. We had Alderperson Anthony Beal saying everyone should be ashamed that this giant deal was going to be voted on with no debate, and there's a lot of back and forth with the mayor, and eventually they rescinded that so people could have their qualms heard.
So Alden, while we are on the topic of what the city can afford, I want to touch on what Chicago residents can afford, or rather what they can't afford. The rent is still too darn high, isn't it?
It is. It's too darn high. It's rising faster than what people are earning. And it's actually been going on for quite some time. The analysis that we did over several months, great work by Amy Chen. You know, we looked at, you know, pretty much what the rent was doing for everyday Chicagoans. And we were thinking about everyday Chicagoans being someone who earns right at the city's median household income. It's an even harder situation for individuals who are lower income. But even for the typical Chicago resident, the rents have increased a great deal. Yeah. So in the past 20 years or so, we're looking at an increase in what we call the median gross rent, which is the cost of your rent and utilities at a median level. That's gone up 28%. The median income in the city has gone up just 9%. So that's one of the real kind of facets of the problem.
I also loved how your piece showed just over time how we used to be able to afford X number of the 77 Chicago neighborhoods, and now a much smaller piece of the pie.
Right. The Loop was the only community that we would consider "quote unquote" unaffordable for the median household. Essentially, the median household couldn't afford reasonably, not paying more than 30% of your rent and utility of your income on rent and utilities. The Loop was the only community where at least half the rents in that community were out of range, out of that 30% of income range for the median household. Today, there are seven communities like that, including the near north side, the near west side, the near south side, Lincoln Park, Lakeview.
Where people just cannot afford to live
there. And it was a small picture, a very small footprint for folks who are at half the median household income, and that footprint has gotten even smaller. 12 communities that they could afford. Today, only five communities that they could afford.
So who's working on potential solutions to this? Because we've known for a while that it's expensive to live here, but it sounds like it's getting worse and like there are no fixes right now.
No grand fixes. You have a number of, I would say, a small community of kind of builders that are really focused on affordable housing. A lot of these are nonprofits, and they're doing, you know, kind of project by project, 50 units here, 70 units there, so on and so forth. And so they're kind of ticking away at the problem. But the larger community of builders has shrunk a great deal. Mm-hmm. And so folks are trying to get in where they fit in. And largely what that has been is looking at the upper end of the market, which is where they can afford and where they can actually kind of pull a profit. Some builders will tell you that's really the only place where we can build a profit. If we go farther down the income range, we're essentially losing money. And there's a lot of talk about this among the building community, particularly those who are using low-income housing tax credits from the federal government, just all of the red tape, and that there's actually a cost. It's actually expensive to go that route, to get the financing through the federal government in order to build these units. And so sometimes the cost per unit for an affordable housing development is even more expensive than it is for a luxury development where the financing is perhaps coming through other sources.
We're feeling it on all ends here. Yeah. So we covered WBEZ's investigation here on Reset into how much Chicago rents have risen in recent years. In much detail, we had Amy Chin on the program on Wednesday. You can find that conversation and her full story up at WBEZ.org. Now, Patrick, in several suburbs, we had primary elections this week. On top of all of the other things, there were primary elections happening this week. In South Suburban Dalton, Jason House had a landslide victory over embattled incumbent Mayor Tiffany Henyard. Please fill us in. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, landslide might be putting it lightly. Embattled, actually, might be putting it lightly as well. I mean, House beat Henyard 88% to 12%.
Wow.
And it's actually a reminder of how quickly fortunes can turn in politics. Henyard won election in 2021. She had 82% of the vote. So think about that switch. I mean, she went from 82% to 12%.
Lots of things have transpired, Patrick.
There are some reasons for that. She faced claims. There was an investigation by former Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot into excessive spending by Henyard, that she hid financial information from trustees and the public. That's in addition to a federal probe into a $200,000 payment to a controversial contractor whose owner was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. I mean, the last time I was on the news roundup, I think there was there was a fight at a meeting where she and her partner were involved.
Fight.
Yes.
Yep.
I don't mean the fight was between her and her partner, but she
no,
and her partner were involved.
No, it was a crowd
involved.
Of folks, and they got right in the middle and defended themselves.
The former mayor apparently was in the middle of that, too.
She was in the center.
She very much was.
I saw that video footage.
Anyway, a lot has happened.
But
which
then
I also
saw a rap video recently on Instagram. She's rapping now.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, hey, good.
That was last week.
I'm sorry that I missed that. I should have shared it. Well, good that she's got a new career, considering that politics might be over.
You paying attention to all this, Alden, Tessa?
I didn't know about the rap video. That's
very news. Interesting.
I'll send it to y'all later. It's quite interesting. No. It's just catchy.
Okay.
Tessa, why don't you fill us in on the mayoral primary in Aurora?
Yeah, so that race went down from 5 candidates. Now it's just 2. It's going to be incumbent Mayor Richard Ervin and Alderman John Lash. They're headed to a runoff election on April 1st. And Ervin, he's running for a third term as mayor, and he's a former alderman who also had a failed bid for governor.
Okay. We also saw primary elections in Cicero, Waukegan, and many other places in the Chicago area. You can find more coverage of this week's suburban elections at suntimes.com/elections. Election day is April 1st. Mm. All right. Before the break, 35th Ward Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, he's going to be leaving Chicago's city council to become superintendent of the Park District. I was today years old when I learned this. Your thoughts, Alden?
Yeah.
Patrick?
Well, so I live in Logan Square. Alderman Ramirez Rosa is not my alderman currently.
Okay.
But my question is, like, is this a promotion? He seems like a very ambitious politician. Certainly he's out in front in the media a lot, one of the progressive leaders. Is this a promotion, Tessa?
You know, I wonder what his calculus was of thinking maybe past just this current term, this current mayor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's going to be another mayoral election in a couple years. I wonder if he thought, is his chances better staying on city council knowing maybe there's a different mayor in power, mm-hmm. so his own positions there will change versus maybe jumping ship to a department and leading an agency. But, you know, he also lost his leadership positions on city council, so his fortunes have kind of changed there. So maybe for him this was, you know, a better deal where he could actually get more done and have more agency and power.
Yeah, sometimes I think about Tony Arnold, who's now one of the editors on our politics desk, as you all know.
Yeah.
He did a story a while back about how every lawmaker in Springfield wishes they were an alderman in Chicago. So I guess that means by that hierarchy, park district leader is above Springfield legislator.
Yeah.
I have a tally at home where I have a ranking.
When does he leave? Do we know?
I don't know exactly. I think it will be sometime late March, early April, but I have to double check that. Today, the Park District Board is having an emergency meeting to consider his appointment, though, where I'm sure some of this will actually be hashed out.
Superintendent of the Park District. Is that desirable right now?
I mean, I think heading up any of these city agencies, quite frankly, comes with a fairly sizable paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to kind of still be in the mix, but to be a little bit under the radar. He's been on the hot seat for quite a bit of time now.
So it's not more money, more problems?
Well, not in this sense, exactly.
It's
more money and maybe a little less problems. And he's still around. There's a chance that, you know, I think he's still strong in his ward. You know, he can come back for that seat at some point, or maybe he's got other aspirations for elected office down
there. Mm-hmm. What happens to his council seat?
Yeah, so Mayor Johnson said he will basically convene a community process to help give input on the successor. Johnson will get to appoint his replacement. And Mayor Lori Lightfoot had a couple of these opportunities, and she had convened different you know, committees to help give her recommendations. But ultimately, the successor will have to be approved by the city council.
So I want to start this section with the trial of Robert Cremo III. That's the alleged shooter in the Highland Park mass shooting on July 4th, 2022. So before we get into details of jury selection, Patrick, just remind folks what happened on this day.
Yeah, this was it was the 4th of July parade in downtown Highland Park in the northern suburbs. Annual tradition. A gunman went up on the rooftop of a downtown business and opened fire with an AR-15 style assault weapon, killing 7 people, wounding 48 others, obviously causing just terror and carnage.
Mm-hmm.
And authorities say that shooter was Robert Cremo III, who was, I believe, 21 at the time of the shooting.
21 at the time. What else should we know about Cremo? I mean, how did he acquire his weapon? What charges is he facing?
Yeah, so he is facing 69 criminal counts against him, all murder and attempted murder. He had another 40-plus for aggravated battery. this is a little technical, but prosecutors dropped those on Monday, which is technically the first day of his jury trial.
Okay.
You mentioned how he got his weapon. His father, Robert Cremo II, was actually charged with a crime because he helped Cremo get his guns when he was under 18. He was an adult by the time of this shooting, but was a juvenile when he first acquired his weapon. He needed his father's sign off.
Right.
His father was charged with a crime because authorities said that he, and I guess he admitted that he should have known his son was dangerous.
You can't do that.
He sponsored him for this. I will say, what else we should know about him? He's bizarre, is probably putting it lightly, considering what he's accused of, but he's behaved very bizarrely during the lead up to this trial.
Like in the courtroom, you mean?
Well, like fired his attorneys and demanded a speedy trial like next month and rehired his attorneys. He said he was going to plead guilty, and a bunch of the victims showed up to court, and then he backed out of that deal. He's just like skipped court dates, he's obviously being held in jail, just refused to go.
Interesting.
He's been acting up a lot as we get into the trial.
Yeah. So I teased jury selection kicked off this week. What did we learn, Patrick?
Yeah. So jury selection concluded on Wednesday. We've got 12 jurors, 6 alternates, 6 men and 6 men and 6 women who are on the jury proper. Nearly everybody who was questioned said they knew about the shooting, but believe they could be impartial.
Mm. Alden, Tessa, are you following this?
I've been seeing Dave Struitt's, tireless tweets every single day of the jury selection. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how long this lasts and once it's actually getting started.
I hadn't realized how much time had passed. This was 2022?
Yeah. Yeah, although I will say, that's a long time. It's been 2.5 years.
Yeah.
As somebody who's covered Cook County before, it feels like they actually got to trial very quickly. It often takes more years than this in Cook County court.
More than 2.5 years?
Yes. I mean, there are people in... Yes. But anyway, we're not here to talk about Cook County. Part of the reason why it's taken so long is there's a prosecutor, I think we heard in one of the clips, prosecutors could call up to 100 witnesses. This is just taking a lot. Even though authorities say that Cremo confessed immediately, it just takes a lot of time to gather the evidence for a crime of this scale.
Mm. Well, what comes next for this trial?
So opening statements are scheduled for Monday morning. Then the prosecutors will start putting on their case. As I mentioned, 100 plus witnesses, including prosecutors say, I think all or nearly all of the 48 living victims are going to testify in this trial. One thing we really don't know is what the defense is going to be. Cremo, as I said, they say they have confession on tape.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't gotten any indication if it'll be an insanity defense or what they're going to say, I should say, when they get to trial. And yeah, Tessa, I'm glad you mentioned Dave Struitt. I'm relying on his reporting and some by our reporter Anna Savchenko for what I'm saying here.
Yeah, Dave Struitt of the Chicago Sun-Times. I'm thinking back to your mentioning of just the erratic behavior throughout this trial from Cremo, and I'm just thinking of the challenges that could be involved here with him. Like, what, this week you said he skipped some of the...
Not this week. In hearings that are sort of like the routine status hearings leading up, he would just refuse to come to court. I'm not saying...
But for the jury, I'm just like, what does that make them think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would assume that his attorneys are telling him to be on his best behavior during the trial.
Right.
I'm not predicting he will do anything or not do anything, but he has been, let's say, unpredictable so far.
Yeah. So... there's another high-profile trial that we got to talk about, Patrick. It's underway here in the Chicago area. It started this week, and we actually could get a verdict as early as this afternoon. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. This is a trial that's happening in the Will County Courthouse, another jury trial. It's a 73-year-old man who's accused of murdering a young Palestinian-American boy from Plainfield.
Mm. So the details in this one are chilling. I want you to just walk us through the allegations that are up against Chuba in the killing of Wadia Al-Fayoumi.
Yeah, so Joseph Chuba is a 73-year-old I mentioned. He was the landlord for Wadia Al-Fayoumi and his family.
Mm-hmm.
He's accused of stabbing Wadia and Wadia's mother. The mother thankfully survived. The child, the 6-year-old boy, did not. This was on October 14th, 2023, shortly after the October 7th Hamas attack and the start of Israel's bombardment of Gaza. Authorities say that Chuba had sort of become radicalized by conservative commentary about the war in Gaza. Wadia's mom testified that Chuba attacked them with a knife while shouting, "You Muslims must die." Their video that was played in trial showed Chuba saying to Will County sheriffs that he was afraid they were, quote, going to do a jihad on me. So he's charged with a hate crime in addition to murder. And I will say that...
Called them, quote, infested rats.
Yes.
According to the mother.
Yes. And I will say our own Mike Puente was out at the courthouse earlier this week. I'm also relying on reporting by Sophie Sherry, excellent reporter at the Sun-Times.
Yeah. So what is next in this case?
So closing arguments were just wrapping up. They might have already wrapped up while we're here talking. Goes to the jury.
That's pretty quick.
Yes, this trial, I mean, the Cremo trial could last 2 months. This trial wrapped up in really less than a week, basically a week's time. And we could get a verdict this afternoon, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Yikes. Did you all see this near collision that happened on Tuesday morning at Midway?
Yeah. I saw it. It was pretty freaky.
Everyone nods in fear. No, that was, I think I was a little late to that. I didn't see the video or hear the audio for a little bit. But, I mean, what were your reactions when you first saw it, Alden?
I mean, it was chilling. But I have to say, watching the plane approach and literally, like, practically on the ground.
Yeah,
and
almost
then,
landed.
And then ascend, that pilot must have nerves of steel because it almost looked like it was scripted.
Like it was planned, like he was supposed to do that. It was very smooth.
Right.
What was going through your mind, Tessa?
Yeah, I was like, thank God his training kicked in like that. He was just thinking fast on his own. Because like you said, it looked like he just knew exactly what to do. It looked like it was part of the plan, that it didn't look jerky or like he was, you know, even getting too close, like he was going to run into him. But it definitely freaked me out a little bit. I feel like post-pandemic, I've gotten sometimes more nervous when I think too hard about the fact that I'm like in a tin can in the air.
Oh my goodness.
And so I was like, I don't know. Yeah, even though it is very safe to fly. But I think seeing these videos happen, especially recently, it makes you, it makes me a little nervous all the time.
Well, when you put it like that, Tessa, tin can.
I think it was, I saw some reporting of at least one passenger who was on the plane who was like, well, I had no idea that we had a near miss until somebody showed me the video, which, makes you think of times where you didn't know. Not that I think, oh, we were always secretly in danger, but something like that could happen and you're in the plane, you have no idea. But thank goodness that the pilot, I feel like people make jokes about, it's all autopilot, you don't even need it.
Right.
I'd say that's a good example of why you need a really well-trained pilot.
He was paying attention. Well, let's hear just how calm he was. Now, here we have some audio of the air traffic controller actually talking to the pilot of this business jet, FlexJet 560. That pilot was not following instructions, it sounds like. And then we'll also hear the pilot of the Southwest flight.
FlexJet 560, turn left on runway 4 left, cross runway 31 left, and hold short of runway 31 center.
Right, left on 4 left, cross the 13 center, FlexJet 560.
FlexJet 560, negative, cross runway 31 left, hold short runway 31 center.
Southwest 2504 going around.
FlexJet 560, your instructions are to hold short of runway 31 center.
So 2504, when able, turn left heading 220.
Left heading 220, southwest 2504. FlexJet 560, hold right there, sir. Don't move.
Hold to this 560.
That's tower, southwest 2504. How'd that happen?
So that's the Southwest pilot. How'd that happen, he says. Remarkably calm.
I was going to ask, are we listening to the right tape?
Because like there was a near miss. I swear, they almost collided. The next morning, I heard a transportation expert say on NPR's Morning Edition, air travel continues to be the safest form of transport. I don't know how much I believe that, though. You're in a car. There are lots more cars on the road around you. There's much more risk, I think, involved.
Yeah.
I'm teetering between. I don't know if we're just seeing more of these stories now because I feel like after the 20th of January, we just started seeing a lot of these types of collisions and near misses in the sky, whereas we didn't before. This stuff just didn't really get reported. I mean, as a journalist, I'm telling you, like, we just don't really hear.
Well, I mean, there hadn't actually been, I mean, from what I understand, there hadn't been, like, a major crash in years. I mean, maybe even over a decade. And then we've had a few. We had the Reagan collision.
Yeah.
There was a crash in Alaska. There was another crash in Philadelphia. So we have had a few.
The flip in Toronto.
Right, in Toronto, right. So we've had some major incidents that certainly are a little nerve-rattling. But in terms of these near misses, like we saw at Midway, apparently those things actually happen pretty frequently.
They do?
About average about four a day. Forbes was reporting on this earlier this week. Yeah, I mean, across the country.
Four a day?
Yeah. Not at Midway.
Let's clear that up. Four a day in Chicago. No.
Near misses, what they call runway and... I'm missing the term now, but
I missed that day in aviation class.
but it's actually a lower. There was about just under 1,500 last year, and that was actually a decrease from the year before.
Oh my goodness! So. Have any of y'all ever experienced turbulence or a bird strike or any kind of close call while you were on a flight?
Well, this one wasn't when I was on a flight, but like many summers ago when I back was a little intern for the Chicago Tribune, I had to cover a small plane landing on Lakeshore Drive. And it was just this very small, like I think maybe only two-seater, small little, you know, privately piloted plane. And they just started to run low on fuel and had to make this emergency landing. And they flew under the footbridge and managed to land on Lakeshore Drive.
Oh, my goodness.
And no one got hurt. And it was pretty stunning. But it was not every day that you see a plane on Lakeshore Drive.
Right, exactly.
I've definitely experienced turbulence. Not that I know of, haven't experienced any near misses. Although, as we find out, you might not necessarily know. I personally, like, beyond the statistics... For me, flying is not comfortable, but I don't find it scary. I'm like, well, these people know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They don't crash that often.
My sister's one of those that has to like take meds that make her fall asleep before she gets on because she just thinks the worst every time. My dad is currently on a flight as we speak. Oh, actually, he's supposed to be landing in the next like 20 minutes. And so I'm just
Do you want to stop the show for a second?
We can just pause for just a minute while I refresh the Air Canada website and just make sure.
I've never had any really bad experiences on the commercial flight. But I'll say the coolest and the scariest flight I took was in an old Stearman airplane. It was like a World War One type fighter plane.
Oh, cool.
This is doing an internship in Galesburg many, many, many moons ago. And
how many?
Another many. And it's a two-seater, so I was in the back seat. And, you know, we're like, I think World War One fighter jet. That's what we were. We didn't do a loop, but we did something very close to it. It was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. Yeah. When I got on the ground, I thought to myself, I don't know if I can ever do that again.
See, my internship was here at BZ. I didn't get to do anything with planes at all. That sucks.
Yeah, I'm sorry to make you feel bad, Patrick, but I also flew in a small plane. Not for an internship, but for, you know, an early career job in Eastern Toronto. So, yeah, you're the only one.
Well,
you're the only one. Alden, I think we figured out what you were trying to say earlier. Was it runway incursions?
That's it. Thank you.
So a runway incursion is any occurrence at an aerodrome involving the incorrect presence of an aircraft, vehicle, or person on the protected area of a surface designated for the landing and takeoff of aircraft.
That sounds very technical.
It's from the FAA. All right, since we're talking about transportation, I wanted to get your thoughts on Chicago announcing that it's installing 50 more speed cameras. Go.
Well, you know, it's hard. Like, I'm hesitant to weigh in. It feels almost like a political issue. But I will say that, like, I think the research shows that speed cameras make streets safer. And I don't mind them as a way to raise revenue. I've gotten caught by them before.
Yes.
I'm not saying I like them. But at the same time, if you don't want to pay the ticket, don't speed.
It's interesting that this is, you know, I feel like all the feedback we heard from aldermen were also similar arguments we heard, though, when the city council was recently debating lowering the citywide speed limit to 25 miles per hour, you know, because proponents are saying this is, you know, a safety issue. You have much less risk of, you know, getting severely injured or fatally, you know, injured if you get hit by a car and it's going slower at 25 miles per hour. But the opposition we heard from a lot of alderpersons, you know, was the presence of speed cameras and the fact that they are not equitably distributed, that some communities are hit harder than others.
Right.
You know, BZ had a big investigation a few years back about the debt that folks are facing from tickets and it's disproportionately hitting low-income residents. So I feel like, yeah, it's interesting how, you know, there's these arguments of safety, but also equity all tied up into this.
Yeah, Alden, you've looked into that a bunch.
Yeah, and the thing that I think is interesting around the whole question of lowering this citywide speed limit from 30 to 25 miles an hour, so we tried to find an instance where that has happened in the past. And we couldn't find an exact instance, but the closest thing was when they dropped, under Mayor Lightfoot, they dropped a threshold for getting a ticket through a speed camera from driving more than 10 miles over the limit to driving more than 5 miles over the limit. And the number of speed camera violations just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. I think they more than tripled, and we still haven't come down to that level. So we're still learning to drive essentially 35 miles an hour as opposed to 40 miles an hour, which is where you would get ticketed before. Yeah. And so that's, I think that is a concern. And the thing, too, around more speed cameras is two things I think are really kind of interesting with this. One is that, you know, in the area where we can't get a property tax increase, in the area where we can't get, you know, bring Chicago home failed for the real estate transfer tax, the graduated income tax statewide, that failed. Seems like Chicago in particular is trying to find whatever way it can to find revenue. And this has been a golden goose in some respects because it can be done without a whole lot of fanfare. And it's good money.
Yeah.
You know, it's automated enforcement. And as bad as things are here in Chicago, in New York, it's way worse. New York was one of the cities where they talked about, you know, look what New York's seen these traffic safety improvements by dropping their speed limit from 30 to 25 miles an hour. But what needs to be stated with that as well is that they're using speed cameras, and they're using them far more on a grander scale than Chicago. I think they have 8 to 10 times more speed cameras
and pulling in a lot of revenue from all that.
Yeah,
so it's the revenue, but it's also, you know, as Patrick said in the beginning, that safety piece, which is important. Speed cameras overall, they do reduce the number of crashes and crash injuries.
Yeah, and as long as I'm staking out positions, which I don't think I'm really supposed to do, put me down for pro speed cameras, but anti-regressive, what are basically regressive taxes, if there's a way to find the middle ground. And to the equity point, I mean, I think the Tribune first reported on these new speed cameras. We still don't know where they're going to be. Right. That is a big question still, where they're going to be located.
Yeah, the city could still change some things with regard to, like, I think one of the things was if you're less than 6 miles over the limit, you only pay maybe $30 or $35. Mm-hmm. And if you're more than 10 miles over, you're $100.
Oh,
and
then $100, so there are tiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then $100 doubles if you don't pay it within a certain amount of time. And I think that's the thing that really, if you're a low-income earner and $100 is a hefty bill for you, you know, you may not be able to come up with that in the amount of time that the city needs you to pay it before it doubles. Now, you can get on a payment plan and things like that, which I actually have a few tickets and I'm on payment plans for. And it's not necessarily the most accessible thing to do online. So there are some things I think the city can do that can make for those folks who don't slow down or aren't slowing down quickly enough or adjusting to the limits quickly enough, where it is not quite as much of a financial strain as it is currently.
Yeah, that doubling thing, that's important because you think about a bill that's hard to pay is one that you might kind of put off a little bit. And then, if it's a bill that you're like, oh, yeah, that's nothing. I guess I'm speaking for myself as a procrastinator. If I get a bill that's going to put a real dent in it, yeah, I tend to be like, I'll think about that in a minute. And that can get you, especially if you can't afford it.
All right, putting a loop on this transportation conversation, I just checked. My dad has landed.
Okay,
thank goodness.
Yay.
He's safe. So, Alden, sticking with you for a moment here, Governor Pritzker and other Democrats say that the Trump administration is holding up about $1.9 billion in federal funding that our state relies on. And the governor traveled to Washington this week to call on that funding to be released. Now, I want to play a little bit of him at a press conference yesterday explaining that approach.
We, of course, are in every circumstance looking at what is our redress. Can we go to court? And if not, are we, you know, is there some other way that we can get that funding source turned back on?
Yeah, being in limbo, not a good feeling, is it?
Not at all, and especially for a state that is, kind of cash-strapped. I mean, Pritzker just, finished a whole budgeting cycle on his own, which, I think it kind of managed that successfully to some degree, but not without a great deal of pain and strain. Local governments, whether state or municipalities or counties, are incredibly reliant on what they get from the federal government. And this is an administration that has said, hey, we're going to play hardball for the things that they want. And this is one of the ways in which they're doing it. There may be some redress legally, and it may actually have to be the only way that Pritzker or anyone else who's in a situation like this, and, you know, Chicago might be in a very situation like this pretty soon as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the courts have been one way in which folks have pushed back on some of the hardcore tactics that the Trump administration has done through the executive orders and so on and so forth. And this may be a new way in which people can combat that. Although I don't know exactly what the legal argument might be. The federal government grants these dollars and, you know, it It's still maybe the purview of the federal government.
What happens, Tessa, if these federal funds don't materialize for the state?
Yeah, they've warned that there's a danger programs may have to pause operations, cancel projects, or lay off staff. You know, being in this, I'm sure, kind of confusing and chaotic time, you know, there's still bills to pay, mm-hmm. programs that need to be funded. The letter that they sent warned that some of these frozen funds impact programs that provide technical assistance for small businesses, affordable solar energy for low-income residents, improve roads and bridges and more. And, you know, Governor Pritzker, he was also in D.C. this week, also sounding the alarm on a pending cut to Medicaid that will strip coverage for more than 700,000 Illinois residents. Mm. And he's warned, you know, the state cannot afford to foot that bill and cover everyone for the billions it would cost if that happens.
Right. When it comes to criminal justice, Patrick, I mean, are there funds that typically come to the city or the state that help with crime reduction? And what happens now with the Trump administration?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Honestly, you look at any agency, if you know, the police department gets a lot of federal dollars, as does the sheriff, as does any agency you want to look at gets a lot of federal dollars. I mean, I've done a lot of reporting on non-police solutions to violent crime, and the Biden administration was a real leader in giving federal dollars to programs that hire, you know, people who've been in prison or former gang right. members to try to prevent shootings. I think all of that is at risk, both with this immediate pause, but also, you know, looking forward at what the Trump administration is going to want to fund in the future from the Justice Department.
Yeah. Any other portions of this federal funding that you're keeping an eye on, Tessa, on your beat?
Yeah, I think the city, you know, could really be put in a pretty hard place really fast. It's already facing the cliff of ARPA funds, the federal pandemic relief dollars. It's already been feeling that squeeze, having to plan for that, having to shift some of those dollars to help plug the budget gap that mm-hmm. it just had. And so to have more federal dollars in jeopardy on top of that could really be a double whammy and hit the city pretty hard. You know, before Dorval Carter stepped down, leading the CTA, one of his final acts was touting a funding agreement to help ensure that the Red Line extension would receive its full amount of federal funding. But, you know, projects like that are what are some of the ones that could be jeopardy if these federal funds get right. clawed back somehow?
Yeah, we've been keeping an eye on that. I know statewide, folks are just trying to, as much as possible, look at all the real world impacts of this Trump administration and their decisions, rather than focus on what if stories, right? Now, case in point, WBEZ's Mike Puente, he talked to a federal worker who lost his job at Indiana Dunes National Park amid a purge of federal workers. He says the first few days after losing his job, he felt a little bit about himself.
Because it's upending my life again, I now have to start looking for other work, or do I try to wait out some legal proceeding? I mean, this is not the fat that is supposedly out there in the federal government. These are working class people that are just trying to get ahead and trying to survive that just got cut.
Yeah, again, very real world impacts. That's Eric Anderson speaking. He's a former firefighter with the National Park Service. Another local impact. This week, a Chicago parent was detained by federal agents at a school drop-off, you know, for what's believed to be the first time in our area as the Trump administration is ramping up their immigration crackdown. Your reaction to hearing that story, Alden?
I think it's a realization of a lot of fears.
I thought school drop-offs were off limits.
And I think, you know, one of the first things that kind of came out of the administration when they were talking about the crackdown that they were going to do, and I don't know if it was a mandate that was stated in a very formal way, but the fear was that this administration is not going to abide by kind of what had been custom, you know, what was off limits.
Yeah.
They've been very aggressive. They've been very public about it, and all through the campaign. Thinking back to the first Trump administration when I was leading the Race, Class, and Communities desk, their immigration reporter, Maria Zamudio, you know, this was a constant drumbeat in her coverage of immigrant communities in Chicago. It's just an incredibly chilling effect. And then, I mean, there's been actual activity. There was a lot of kind of big and bold talk, but mm-hmm. there was not as much, at least here locally, is not as much activity on the ground, but the fear was still palpable. And you could go into these communities in Little Village and Pilsen and like these bustling kind of street scenes and commercial yeah. districts were just like quiet, like you could hear a pin drop in many of these places. And now is that same chilling effect with all of the kind of discussion of brown immigration coming in through the campaign. But in the first days of this administration, they have really kind of backed backed up that big talk.
They sure have.
It's having an incredible impact.
And that was, of course, great reporting by our Sarah Karp. Tessa, speaking of local officials heading to Washington, Mayor Johnson's going next week. What's he doing on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so Johnson is going to go before the House Oversight Committee to testify before Congress with the mayors of New York City, Denver, and Boston. And they're all being called to testify because their cities are sanctuary cities, and the Republican-led committee is doing a probe into sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. They've argued that these cities' policies, these protections, are, you know, stymieing the federal immigration enforcement that they're trying to carry out. And it's definitely going to be high stakes and lots of drama. The committee already put out a nearly 3-minute video this week teasing the hearing next week. There's a U.S. Constitution in flames, cutting to images of the mayors dramatic music, and, you know, the Trump giving this opening salvo. And the gist of the video is connecting sanctuary cities to increased crime, which, you know, research has not borne out. But it, you know, is, I think that's some of the tenor of what we're going to see come next week. And it's definitely going to be very high stakes for Johnson, and probably one of the biggest stages we've really had to see him on. So I think there'll be lots of eyes watching how he does.
Well, my thanks to all three of you, because boy, did we get through a lot of stories today. We've been speaking with an all WBEZ panel for this week's weekly news recap. We had WBEZ criminal justice editor Patrick Smith, WBEZ city government and politics reporter Tessa Weinberg, and WBEZ data projects editor Alden Lowry. Have a great weekend. You earned it.
You too.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks, Sasha.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Dan Tucker. It was mixed by Ari Mejia. Every Friday, we bring you the roundup of the biggest headlines of the week. To stay informed and never miss an episode, subscribe wherever you listen, or you can find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Take care, and thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.